It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and yes, that is the On the Money theme you are listening to. Kevin McKinley is here with On the Money today. We're talking about the fiduciary rule and whether or not brokers are free to have conflicts of interest that may harm their clients. We're also going to look at serial returning. This is buying one of every size online and then returning what you don't want. Companies are starting to notice this, and they're starting to be irritated. What is your personal finance question? Call us at 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kevin McKinley, of course, is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us this morning in our WPR studios in Madison. He is sitting right next to me. Kevin, welcome back.
Hello, Carrie. The temporary restraining order finally expired, and I'm allowed to come back into the studios.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah, we'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. So this fiduciary rule, this was a rule designed to protect investors' interests. It is basically now dead.
Yeah, the fiduciary rule was inspired by the Obama administration in the Department of Labor, and it was enacted in 2016 after 5 years of working on it. And basically what it said, if an advisor or salesperson or financial planner, stockbroker was handling retirement assets like IRAs and Roth IRAs and 401ks, that they must put the investor's interest first before their own interest. And it's a legal standard. For example, the advisor could recommend lots of different kinds of investments, but they had to do what was the best one for the investor, even if it cost the advisor money. And that could mean putting them in low-cost index funds on a fee-based account versus putting them in an annuity that pays a high commission. And it's kind of like, when you take your car into the shop and you say, I need all new brakes. And the mechanic looks at it. What you hope the mechanic might say is, no, you don't need all new brakes. You just need pads and only on the front set of brakes for it. So you save yourself a lot of money. And you'd like that in your mechanic. You'd like that in your physician. You'd like that in just about anybody who's charging you money. You want them to get paid for a fair amount of work, but you don't want to pay any more than you have to. And if there's a less expensive way to get it done, you'd prefer that they offer that up even if it costs them money. And the move was to keep the fiduciary rule in place was applauded by AARP, Consumer Federation of America, Consumer Reports, etc.
The Obama administration did this. Were there actually brokers who were taking fees? And how widespread was this?
Well, it wasn't so much they were taking fees. They were taking more fees than maybe was necessary. They were charging more and earning more in commission from selling products than they could have by offering lower cost alternatives.
And the rule is no longer in effect. Now what?
Well, it was challenged by financial services firms who obviously didn't like it. They said, and there's some merit to this. They said it's too costly to serve smaller investors if we can't make more money off of them. I'm not sure that that's the case, especially how scalable financial service can be other than the human interaction for it. A lot of this stuff is done online, and once you build the platform for it, it's relatively low cost to serve it. It was also challenged in court by the Chamber of Commerce, several different life insurance companies, and also index annuity sales groups as well. The Trump administration was on their side. Within a couple of weeks of Trump taking office, he mentioned that this is something he didn't care for. There was one last chance to keep it in place, but it was recently lost in court, and now the parties aren't contesting it anymore.
So what is next? Can brokers just take a kickback from a securities company and then give it to me even if it's not a good security?
Yeah, that's one of the issues. Is they said, well, we don't want people like advisors to be motivated by, put so many dollars of your client's money into a particular product. You want a trip to Hawaii or whatever.
Right.
They didn't like that kind of thing because obviously that would sway some people to recommend something that the client didn't know that there was a cheaper alternative for at first. But for investors, advisors, regulators, everybody, there's just a lot of confusion right now. Some firms had already invested tons of money to try to adhere to the fiduciary rule, and they're sticking with it, even though they don't necessarily have to. They're channeling more of their clients' money into fee-based accounts rather than commission accounts. Others have already gone back to the old way of doing business, and in fact, I'm on a lot of different email lists for the financial advice industry. And just the other day, I got an email. It was a mass email, but it was from an insurance sales company. And they said, hey, we just want to remind you, you're not fiduciaries anymore, so you can still sell our product whenever you feel like it anymore. And I was a little disappointed by how quickly and how excited they were to be able to to send that out for. And there are some other rules being put in place right now called the best interest exemption, where they're trying to make basically everybody held to the same standard, whether you're a broker, financial planner, whatever, that everybody's held to the same standard. But obviously, they're having a hard time doing that.
Is it possible that the industry will police itself on this?
They'll try to. But they have to all, like all industries that police themselves, they have to balance it out between we want to make as much money as we possibly can. Mm. And so they want to uphold a decent reputation or try to restore the reputation if they can. But it's very difficult. And there are so many different large competing parties who say, no, I want to be held to the fiduciary standard. I'm okay with this. And other ones who say, we don't want to be held to that, but we don't want to look bad by asking for it.
So individuals, people who save, what can we do in light of these changes?
Yeah, ask your advisor, your planner, whoever's trying to sell you some kind of financial product, are you a fiduciary or not? And if you're not a fiduciary, why are you not a fiduciary? They'll probably say something like, well, we do a good job for you. And they are still required to offer you securities that are suitable for your situation. And just because you're working with a fiduciary doesn't necessarily mean that person's the best one for you. And just because the person's not a fiduciary doesn't mean that he or she isn't good for you as well. But you would probably want someone who's held to a legal standard to give you the best advice regardless of how much money they earn from it. Ask them how they're paid. Ask them what expenses you are paying as an investor and what services you are going to receive. And most importantly, say, are there any lower cost options to working with you versus what you're currently recommending to me?
So speaking of investing, you have a special themed plan for next week's show.
Yes, it's an On Your Money tradition like no other. It's going to be the week of Independence Day. And so we're going to have a special show devoted to making sure that you are on track to becoming financially independent. And if you're not, how to improve your situation. If you're retired and you feel like you're financially independent, we are going to also tell you how to stay that way. And we're going to give out our most requested item that we ever ask, pick your favorite musical artist for it. And when the song that everybody yells, that Freebird version, this is our version of Freebird, where we give out the equation that you can use regardless of your situation to not only figure out if you're on track to becoming financially independent, but how much money you actually need. And that's a special show next week.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. So we are talking to Kevin. He's in our studios today, and we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234 on your money. At WPR.org is the email. And you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've got a couple of calls already. Hannah from Ellison Bay, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Am I on?
You are on the air, ma'am.
Okay, good. I'm calling because my son bought a house and was offered a couple of different mortgage rates, and one for 3.9 and one for 4.625, and I advised him, as I have always heard Kevin say, take the 30-year mortgage. The other, the 3.9 was 3.9 for 7 years, and then after that, you would have to refinance. However, he's only going to stay in the area about 5 years, so he was asking me which one he should take, and I just told him 30 years because that's what Kevin always says. So now I wonder, did I give him good advice or not?
Yeah, welcome to my world, Hannah. I wake up every day asking, did I give that person good advice or not? Mm. Here's the why I like the 30-year mortgage. First of all, it gives you the lowest possible payment, usually. And that allows you to get into a home you might not otherwise get into. And it also gives you more flexibility because with most mortgages, you can pay off more than the minimum payment if you wish to retire the debt faster and you don't have any other financial needs. Your retirement savings, college savings, credit cards are paid off. All that's taken care of. And then you can retire it if you want. But if you don't want to, you have this low payment that might be, you know, $800 a month or whatever. And all you have to do is make that single payment, and that allows you to stay in the house for 30 more days before you figure out where the next $800 is going to come from. Hannah, do you know if there was a difference in the mortgages in terms of, like, points? Did you have to pay anything extra up front for a different mortgage, or was that kind of similar?
I didn't have the feeling that was a question, or maybe he just didn't tell me that. No, I just know that it was a 7-year, and then you could refinance. But
okay.
I was worried that there would be, that would be an adjustable mortgage, and then you might not be so able to have. Your payments would be maybe much greater.
Right.
So
and you said, Hannah, that he's probably not going to stay in the house much longer than a few years?
Yeah, than 5 years or so. Then they move out of the area after about 5 years.
Okay, and so, that how likely would you say that's going to happen?
That is probably likely because his wife is getting her PhD and she's going to be looking for a job somewhere in the United States, so I think they probably will move after about 5 years or so.
Okay, yeah, I'm fine with that. I think that's okay. I don't think it's the biggest mistake. If they think there's a chance they're going to remain in that house even after she earns her PhD, then I'd go with that 4.625% because that's a fixed rate over all 30 years, correct?
Okay, that's better.
Yeah, that's okay. Better. But in their case, I'd say they're okay going with that. One of the things that they might want to think about, if all the other points and everything are different, they'll notice that the payment amount between 3.9% and 4.625% is not dramatic. It might be on a, you know, $200,000 home. It might be $50 a month, maybe. And if they think there's a chance they're going to stay in the area, then I would probably go with a higher interest rate one. But if they think, no, we're done regardless, then, yeah, I think they can sneak by with that 3.9% one that's adjustable. And, you know, just because they take it out now, they don't have to sit on it for 7 years. They can, if they want to, they can refinance to a fixed one between now and the time that the mortgage actually adjusts.
Thank you very much for that question, Hannah. We are talking to Kevin McKinley on today's On Your Money, and we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Don from Shorewood has a similar question for you, Kevin.
Good morning. Well, welcome, Carrie. It's good to have you with us. And
thank
Kevin,
you.
You're brilliant.
All right, Don, anything. You got the whole rest of the hour.
Yeah, this must be Mortgage Monday or morning for nervous parents looking for advice for their kids. My son and his partner are in the process of purchasing a house. They're in the delightful position of being able to make a choice between paying 20% or 25% down on the house. They're fully funding their retirement benefits. They have 6 months of emergency funding available to them, so they're in a really good financial position. The 4.6 30-year interest they're looking at, and the question that my son has, which I think is an objective one, while I'm giving him subjective advice, is would he be better off paying the 25%, saving $1,000 in closing costs, and doing that as opposed to the 20%. So is there an objective way to look at, you know, financially, which is the better way to go? Subjectively, I told him, take the 30-year, pay 20%, hang on to your money, and do what you want. But he'd like an objective answer.
Yeah, Don, I'm sorry. I'm subjective as well. But I'm the same subjective answer. I have the same subjective answer that you do. So I agree with that. And especially with younger adults starting out, you just really have to keep as much cash on hand as you possibly can. Low mortgage rate interest does not typically end up being the death knell for people's financial security. It's lack of cash flow, especially in the loss of a job or an unexpected expense to the house, to their cars, medical expense, childcare, what have you. That's what really hurts people. Now, your son sounds like he's in really good shape. By putting at least a 20% down, he's avoiding the private mortgage insurance, correct?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah, 20% is a nice minimum, because if you can avoid the private mortgage insurance, that's a great deal. But no, I'd much rather have him just put that money in his checking account, only put the 20% down, save it, and I hope that, you know, the extra interest that he pays and the $1,000 on the mortgage is the worst financial tragedy he ever experiences.
Thank you very much, Don. We are taking your questions for Kevin McKinley on today's On Your Money, 800-642-1234. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. Our On the Money Hour with Kevin McKinley this morning has been about safe investing in fiduciary responsibilities. I would like to talk about 529 accounts in a moment, but what is your question for Kevin? 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Morning. So, Kevin, 529 Edvest accounts. This means that the money is not taxable. We have an emailer that says that she planned on returning to school for her master's, and her husband and her are wondering about the best way to plan. They don't have much money. So what should they do for their 529s?
Yeah, the 529s, the Edvest, I think she's asking about the tax deduction and what the tax break means. When you put money into a 529 account, Wisconsin's version is the Edvest, but you can use any state's plan regardless of your state of residence and regardless of where the kid lives and regardless of where the kid is going to go to school. And so you have basically four different variables you can use from. But if you're a Wisconsin resident and you use the Edvest plan, you get a small state income tax break on the deposit, and then, like all 529 plans, any future investment earnings in that plan are sheltered from taxation. If you pull the money out and use it for qualified higher education expenses, and that definition is pretty liberal, it's room, board, tuition, books, etc., there is going to be no taxes when you pull the money out. But if you pull it out and spend it on a car or a boat or some other non-qualified use, you'll pay taxes on the earnings plus a 10% penalty on that amount.
We are talking about On Your Money with Kevin McKinley. We've been discussing tax deductions. Actually, we're going to take some phone calls. Sherry from Oshkosh, welcome to the program.
Morning.
Morning.
Hi. I just wanted to thank Kevin for his time and his excellent advice. I listen regularly.
Thank you very much.
Are you there?
For your kind words.
Okay, I had to start that way. I know you like it, but it is true. I have a question about my RMD.
Okay.
I'll be 70 and a half at the end of July of next year.
Okay.
2019. What's the earliest I can take out money from my IRA to be used for my RMD?
Okay. So the rule is you have to take your first required minimum distribution out usually by April 1st of the year after you turn 70 and a half. But if you wait to April 1st to do that, then you have to take another one out December 31st of the same year. So kind of like double dipping. And depending on your income situation, that may mean you get taxed more because you're taking more income out. You're taking two RMD payments in a single calendar year. So the first time you can take it out and qualify for an RMD is the calendar year in which you turn 70 and a half. So you're probably better off just taking it out in 2019. Then you'll have to take one out that year, and then you take one out every year subsequently until death releases you from this mortal coil.
In 19, is I have to wait until I'm actually 70?
No, that's a good question. You only had you can take it out January 2nd of 2019, and it will qualify.
Some home improvements that I need some money for.
Yeah, your neighbors have called us. They suggested you get to work on that home improvements right away.
Okay, but like by March,
yep.
If I took it in March, it still would count for my RMD?
Still qualifies as the RMD, that's correct.
Wonderful. That was my question. Okay. Thanks a whole lot.
Thank you, Sherry. We are talking with Kevin McKinley this morning about On Your Money, 800-642-1234. We are taking your phone calls. The 529 plans that we were talking about earlier, are there downsides to these plans?
Yeah, it depends on, like we said, how the withdrawals are handled. What happens is going back to Amanda's question, you can pay the qualified expenses with a check, and then you pull the money from the 529 in the calendar year of expenses, or you can have the money transferred directly from the 529 to the school. But it's usually just it's better off in a parent's or grandparent's case if they pull money out just to meet it in the same calendar year in which the expenses are incurred and the money's paid.
And as we talked about before, should these 529 plans be in the child's name or the parent's name?
Usually in the parent's name, because unless the money is already in the child's name and you're sliding it over from his or her account into a 529 account, you don't want to give the child the access to the money because it will hurt their financial aid, their need-based financial aid, and it gives the child total control over the money when he or she reaches the age of majority.
We are talking about money matters with Kevin McKinley this morning. 800-642-1234. Email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Meredith from Wisconsin Dells called earlier. She got her mortgage statement, and she says that she qualifies to recast her loan. She asks, what does this mean?
Well, recasting is basically, we alluded to it a little earlier, but it's paying down a bunch of principal all at once without changing the length of the mortgage or the interest rate. So let's say you have a mortgage outstanding of 30 years left, and it's $100,000. And you have $20,000 that you want to apply towards that mortgage, which will then lower your payment and eliminate a lot of the interest on that $20,000. If the bank, not every bank or lender will do this for you, but many do, they'll allow you to recast it, which says you don't have to refinance, you don't have to pay a bunch of costs for new assessments, appraisals, whatever. But you can then lower the payment down by applying that $20,000 directly to the $100,000. And you're going to be getting lots of solicitations from your lender and other lenders lately because as interest rates rise and as the pace of home sales slows down, a lot of people want to buy houses, but there just aren't that many for sale. Mortgage lenders are not only looking for other places to earn money, but they're also trying to protect their own mortgages from being poached by other lenders. And so you're going to be hearing a lot of different things about refinancing your mortgage, about seeing if you can get a lower interest rate or more money out of it, et cetera. Recasting is one of those areas where the lenders are going to be going after homeowners in a big way.
Is this a good idea?
Yeah, it can be, as long as she's covered every single other possible need out there, from saving for retirement, saving for college, paying down high interest rate debt, putting aside 6 to 12 months worth of living expenses, setting aside money for other potential emergencies or home improvements. If there's just no other possible need for that money, yes, paying down the mortgage faster than the rate requires is a good idea. But the interest is so low, it can still be tax deductible, which we will talk about later on in the show. And so, I'd say that is the absolutely last place that she should put her money, only if those other things have already been covered.
We've got another call. Camelia. Camelia, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. My question is about my 529 savings for my children. I have three kids under five, and my husband and I both work. We are doing well with our with regard to our retirement savings and our general savings. So we're in a good spot, and I think that we're already saving pretty well for the 529 accounts. I'm wondering, though, if I should consider increasing my contribution to my kids' accounts and just keep putting additional funds in there while I have the ability to do so, or if there's a trade-off where I'm kind of tying up money there that won't be available for other uses. And also, I'm wondering if there's any limit to how much I can contribute there that I should be aware of, or any penalties or things of that nature.
Yeah, Camelia, those are good questions. it depends on your situation, and I'd much rather have parents save for their own retirement aggressively rather than their kids' college, because you can borrow money to pay for college. You cannot borrow money to retire. And so I'd rather have you make sure that you're maxing out all pre-tax retirement plan savings like 401ks and IRAs, after-tax savings like Roth IRAs. Then and only then would I put more money into the 529 accounts. There are limits to what you can put in, but they're above and beyond most families' needs. It's about $15,000 a year, and then there are ways around that limit as well. So you can technically put hundreds of thousands of dollars a year into those plans if you're willing to use up several years' worth of deposit exemptions. But no, I wouldn't want you to put that much money into that, because depending on the age of the kids, you don't know if they're going to go to college. You don't know what college will be like when they're going. You know, my daughter's in college right now, and she takes a lot of her classes online. I know several other parents who the kids actually are living at home right now and taking a lot of classes online as well. That means that it's not going to be as expensive, hopefully, as it was for our generation, and that means that you might not have to save quite as much money for it as you once did.
We are. Thank you very much, Camelia, for that call. We are talking about financial issues with Kevin McKinley on Your Money. That is the smart assets theme here on Your Money. I love that you start with that, Kevin. What are we talking about today with smart assets?
Well, we have had a lot of questions today already about mortgages, and we've had a question here from Jerry who said, I've been listening to you for 6 years or so. I love your Tuesday morning talk show. Now to the point. I took out a HELOC. You can tell he's been listening a long time because he puts false praise in with the question. He said, I took out a HELOC around 2010 to do some remodeling of my home. Last year, I converted the HELOC to a home equity loan to stabilize the interest rate. So what he did is he had an adjustable rate home equity line of credit, and he swapped that for a home equity loan to get a fixed interest rate. And Jerry says, given that I took the HELOC out for remodeling, can I continue to use the interest paid on the home equity loan as a tax deduction? And then he cleverly throws this in at the end, obligating me to respond. He says, looking forward to your answer.
That's kind of manipulative there.
Thank you in advance for your reply. Right. Looking forward to your answer. So let's cover the basics first. And this was a tricky subject. It's even more so now in light of the new tax changes, because last year in 2017, all this interest would have been tax deductible, up to $1 million on the primary mortgage and $100,000 for a home equity line of credit or a loan. Now, it's still can be tax deductible. Mortgage interest, home equity line of credit interest, and home equity interest is still tax deductible, but only if you use the loan to acquire, build, or substantially improve a property.
Hmm. And did he substantially improve his property? does this count? Somebody come in and look at his property to see if it was...
You didn't improve it, you made it worse.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, no, if you're buying or building a house, obviously that qualifies. That's acquiring or building a house. Substantially improving something is something where it's going to be a gray area. Usually it's something that adds to the cost basis of the house in the eyes of the IRS. So if you're remodeling, probably not. If it's a new addition, probably. If you put on a if you finish the basement out or something, that's probably something that's going to qualify for it too. And interesting in this, and what we've been able to find so far, and this is still a very fluid situation, but on the home equity line of credit interest, it's not grandfathered in. So any other use in the past and the future, whether you used it for cash outs, to pay off your credit cards, bought a car with it, used it for college, whatever, the interest on that home equity line of credit may not be deductible to you anymore.
So this sounds like a huge headache for homeowners. What should they do?
Yeah, I just saw a story on how tax simplification now is just going to be on a postcard and everything like that. Well, this is one other big headache for homeowners, especially if you are eligible for the deduction. But keep in mind, this is only going to be an issue if you have a loan, a mortgage, a home equity line of credit, or a home equity loan, and you haven't used it to buy or build or improve the home, and your itemized deductions exceed $12,000 for singles or $24,000 for married couples filing jointly, because if you're, all of your itemized deductions, including your mortgage interest, don't exceed that, you're not going to need to itemize. You just take the standard anyway. And it's only going to be an issue if you get audited. And the average taxpayer has a less than 1% chance of being audited in any given year. Now, if you do get audited, you've deducted the interest on a loan, the IRS may ask you to say, could we see how that money was used so that we can see that it actually qualifies for it. So you should still document how any proceeds were used, but you just may not be able to take that big tax break in the future.
So does this mean that people should avoid borrowing against their home equity for purposes that don't qualify, like living expenses,
yeah,
or buying that new car? I mean, it seems to me a common sense rule to say, don't borrow to spend.
Yeah, don't borrow to spend, but, you know, if you need food, you need to pay the utility bill, borrow.
Right.
And especially if it's just a short-term issue rather than a lifestyle solution. I still like home equity lines of credit and home equity loans. The interest rate is very low. You can borrow for a very long term, which can keep your payment off loan. You can or keep your payment lower. You can pay it off early if you want, usually with little or no penalty, or you don't have to pay it off at all. But in things like paying off car loans, buying a car, paying for college, I'd much rather have people get specific loans for that purpose, get a car loan, get student loans or Parent Plus loans, rather than tapping into their home equity for it. You should use the home equity only as an emergency.
We are talking to Kevin McKinley this morning and taking your calls. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Marion from Concord is calling with a question. Welcome, Marion.
Good morning. excuse me. I'm 77 years old, and 40 years ago, my then father-in-law gave me $1,000 worth of West Allis State Bank stock. Since then, it has been sold, resold, split. It's now worth $152,000. I took out $22,000 a couple months ago for some needed expenses. I thought, if not now, when? I'll be dead soon. And I would like to know what was the tax rate I would, you know, need to pay next year. Is it 12%?
Yeah. You actually might not have to pay anything on it whatsoever, depending on the rest of your income. As long as you are in the lower tax bracket, Marion, the capital gains, long-term capital gains tax rate could be zero, as high as 15% or so. Do you actually have the cost basis figured out, or is that something you're going to have to dive into all the statements with a calculator and a very sharp pencil?
Well, I guess. I don't know. It's now held by Schwab, and he really wasn't interested in telling me what to do with it, but my daughter did some research. Our income, my husband's income and mine together, is about $77,000 a year. I think that's low.
Yeah, I think you're going to be in good shape on that. The rule is that if you don't know the cost basis of an investment or a security that you've sold, the IRS requires you to use zero as the number. So that you'd have to, technically all $20,000 would be taxable capital gains, but in your situation, your income may be low enough where you would only have to pay little or nothing on the gain. And even if you do, let's say it's 15%, for example. Well, even at a zero cost basis, that's $3,000, which is a heck of a lot more than what it was worth when your grandfather-in-law gave it to you 40 years ago. So I think it's still a pretty good deal. If you can hang on to it for longer, whether it's tomorrow or 20 years from now, when you pass away, then the stock cost basis gets stepped up under today's laws. And so your heirs would have a virtually no capital gain on it. Then they could sell it with no capital gains or capital gains taxes.
Okay, you do know stuff.
he does know stuff. We are talking to Kevin McKinley this morning on today's On Your Money. Next up, we're going to look at chronic returners in the online shopping world. You know who you are. It's On the Money, On Your Money. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. I'm sitting here in studio with Kevin McKinley, a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us on Tuesdays for On Your Money. We repeat this on Saturdays. Also, what is your personal finance question? 800-642-1234. On Your Money at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Bill from Roberts, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. So what's your question?
Hey, a real simple one. I took out a home equity loan to use that money for investment, and that's the only purpose I use it for. And I'm led to believe it's not deductible as interest payment on a HELOC, but it's deductible as cost of the investment. Is that correct?
Yeah. First of all, let's back up for 1 second, Bill. I'm a little concerned about the notion of borrowing money to invest it. Did you buy stocks with it, mutual funds, a house, rental property? What did you do with it, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I basically invested in real estate.
In real estate. Okay. That makes me feel a little better about it. Because is it secure to actually buy the home equity loan?
Yes.
Okay. So you use this loan, and you bought real estate. And when you asked for it, was it part of was it your own home that you borrowed against, or was it the property you purchased?
I bought my own home.
Okay.
And I invested in a real estate company that provided second mortgage on the property.
Oh, okay. That may not be tax deductible, depending on the situation for it too. Do you have a CPA now you use, Bill?
Not at the moment.
Okay, I'd get one because if it's a sizable enough loan and a large enough investment, it might be a case of it's worth it to pay a few $100s or even a few $1,000s, depending on your situation and the CPA, to make sure that it is tax deductible, especially in light of the new law changes.
Okay, thank you very much.
We are taking your calls for Kevin McKinley this morning, 800-642-1234. Jess from Platteville, welcome to the program, Jess.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So my question with the mortgage talk going on here, I bought a house about 2 years ago with a 7-1 ARM. I'm doing a lot of remodeling to it, added a few bedrooms, egress windows in a basement, things like that. It's a pretty major improvement. To get the equity up. I'm wondering with the interest rates, the federal interest rates going up, should I be concerned about refinancing sooner rather than later with my 7-1 ARM?
Yeah, so 7-1 ARM, Jess, that means that you have a fixed rate for 7 years, and then beginning after 7 years after you've taken this out, it can start changing every year. Is that correct? Do I understand you?
Yes, that's what I believe.
Okay, what's the current interest rate on this 7-1 ARM?
I'm trying to think. I think it's right around 4, maybe.
Okay. Do you plan on staying in the place for more than 3 to 5 years?
It's kind of up in the air. I would like to, but depending on kind of how work goes, you know.
Okay.
If I need to move for a job.
Is the house done, or does it still have a lot of work left to do?
There's a lot done. There's more that I could do. I'm just wondering how much, at what point do I have to say, okay, that's enough, and the rates are going to be, you know, where I want to refinance that.
Okay. The interest rate, I think, is worth it to refinance if you think there's a chance you're going to be there for the next 5 to 7 years. Second thing I like about doing it is, since you took this out, home prices have probably increased, and more importantly, the value of the place has probably increased because of the work you've done, correct? Yeah. Okay. So I'd go into the bank now and at least see what they can offer you, both in terms of the valuation, the appraisal, what type of mortgage based on the amount of work that you've done in your situation. And then I would look at a 30-year fix, because you're probably looking at about, again, depending on your situation, about 4.6, maybe 4.7%. And that's not a lot. That's not a big jump from where you're currently at. And I think you could probably maybe even get some money out of the mortgage if you needed to finance any more of these improvements. So the worst thing, you know, they could do is say no, and then you're still right back in the same situation for it. But I would definitely pursue it and see what they say, and then decide and call back if you feel like it.
Is that going to cost me an appraisal before I could talk to the bank, or can I just go talk
to the bank? No, you can talk to the bank right now, and then they'll decide. They might look at the last appraisal. They might decide, and it might be in your advantage to pay for the appraisal. You know, if it's $400 or $500 or whatever, that might be a significantly bigger number than what it was when you got this 7-1 arm, and therefore that might give you access to a lot more money that you can then use to do even more work and increase the equity even more.
We are taking your calls this morning for Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney@wpr.org. Lynn from Northern Iowa called earlier. She wonders what a reasonable fee is for a trustee to ask for a trust.
Yeah, 1% is usually about the standard one. You know, they're often done through a bank. It depends on the amount of work done by the trustee as well, but you're usually looking in the 1% range. If it's someone where it's an individual for it and it's a huge trust, that might be more or less depending on the size of it. Sometimes people might have a $20 million trust, and they might do it for a flat fee or a salary. But usually 1% is about the standard rule of thumb for administration of the trust.
And Bob from Columbus, welcome to the program, Bob.
Hi. Pleasure to talk to my favorite alchemist, the man that turns lead into gold. I have
a question, Bob.
On CGAs, mm-hmm. charitable gift annuities. My wife slid this in front of my face this morning for Ag Grace.
Okay.
It sounds like we're going to take a hit on taxes this year. We took a double on our RMD, and my wife is still working. It sounds like... I don't know if you're familiar with it. But
So you're asking what charitable gift annuities are?
Right, if it's just like any other annuity.
It's different because when it's a charitable gift annuity, what you do is you donate some money to this charitable organization, and then you get money back. You not only get a tax break on the initial deposit, but you then get money back, and the amount of money can be dependent upon a time frame. It can be on your lives. It can be on yours and your wife's life. It can be have lots of different variables to it, and then part of the money that you get back, Bob, can be tax-free as well because it's return of principal. The risk is that let's say it's, you know, $100,000, a significant amount of money that you're giving over to this charity. You're hoping that the people running the charitable gift annuity, and it's often not run by the charity per se, it's farmed out to other financial service companies, but you're hoping that they will be around long enough to not only give you your money back as long as you're around, but to honor the terms of the annuity as well. You're hoping they don't lose it. The more generous the terms are, the more likely it is that they're taking a lot of risk with it. It makes it less likely that they may be there 10 or 15 or 20 years from now. So you might want to just take a look at the charity, and it's a really good way to get some income back while still getting a tax break, and especially in your situation where you have a year that may be inordinately higher because of the multiple required minimum distributions and your wife's earned income.
Thank you very much for that. We are talking to Kevin McKinley on Your Money this morning. 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney@wpr.org.
My mama told me you better shop around.
Oh, yeah, the shop around theme. So today, Kevin, we're talking about chronic returners. These are people who order 5 or 6 pairs of shoes, the same shoe because they really like the shoe, but they really don't know how it'll fit them. And then they pick one and then they return the rest. Some people who do this are being added to a list. Talk to me about this.
Right. The National Retail Federation says that 11% of purchases are then returned and 11% of those are fraudulent.
Whoa.
That's about 1%, which doesn't sound like much, but in the retail spectrum, that's billions of dollars. And Amazon has been so dominant in so many things, but especially in their ease of taking sales and making returns for it. People have gotten spoiled by that philosophy. And so other retailers are cracking down. Best Buy, Dick's, JCPenney, Victoria's Secret, etc. Many of these companies are trying to reduce or eliminate returns by targeting people who are returning too many things.
So how is it that they're fraudulent?
Well, they may return something that they've used, or they return something and say that it's broken when they actually broke it. What they really don't like is just the hassle of doing it. And some of these stores are doing the process in-house, but many of them are using a company called Retail Equation, which when I saw that, to me it sounded like a boy band who would be performing at the Mall of America. You know, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for a retail equation. What they do is they use an algorithm just like a credit score to identify current and potential abusers, people who, based on their purchases and their habits, are more likely to return too many things and end up costing the store money.
Interesting. So this is going to push shoppers maybe towards Amazon or towards Zappos, which totally has a return anything policy.
Right. And it's very convenient. But even those companies are doing the same thing. You know, Amazon, for a while there, I've had things in the past where I've said, I'm sorry, this came to me. It wasn't what I expected, or it was the wrong size or whatever. And they've honestly said, just keep it. It's not worth us restocking
true,
it.
Right.
It's low-dollar items. But they are also dealing with the same issues, too. So some of these online, huge online retailers have even used Retail Equation to try to limit serial returners. And they've even, there's cases where the Wall Street Journal reported this a few days ago, that many shoppers have been banned from Amazon, which is hilarious because not only, you know, to be banned from a store for returning them, but then the people plead with the company. They're so dependent upon Amazon that they're saying, please, I'm so sorry. I won't do any more returns. Please take me back. I can't live without Amazon.
So if I get something and it just doesn't fit or it's not really what I expected, I'm not a serial returner. I think it's a hassle to have to do that, actually. Am I going to get penalized? Is this going to affect people who don't kind of take advantage of the system?
Probably not. But you should think before you click and read the terms of the store website or the store, and especially the updates when they send you those things saying we've updated our terms, and you say, yeah, I read it, even though you didn't read it. Actually read them, because they may have changed the return terms, especially recently. And keep in mind, if you buy it online, you may have to print your own shipping label. There might be a fee to send it back. Mm-hmm. There might be a restocking fee put in by the store, whether you buy it online or return it to the store itself. You may be just better off donating the item to charity that you don't want, especially if you can use the donation as a tax break. Now, certain credit cards, though, do offer some protection. So check the terms of your credit card, because even if the store will not take it back based on their policy for you, the credit card might offer you some amends, both in terms of saying, well, we'll cover it for you, the purchase, if you're not happy with it within a certain time period, or we might even withhold payment from the retailer if it's a really egregious issue. And so check your credit card's terms. If it's the one you're used to using that's already logged in at the retailer's website, you might be able to get some redress that way.
I'm wondering, when you get banned from Amazon, how that affects your entire life. Amazon's pretty much taking over the world here.
You can have my wife and my children, but don't take my Amazon account away from me.
We've talked about this before. Yes. We are both Amazon Prime members. Mm-hmm. And
I saw you at the meeting the other night.
Yes,
too, by the way.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Kevin, you have a website of the week. What is today's website of the week?
Yeah, it's FAFSA.ed.gov. It's one we've mentioned before. It's the financial aid website. If you have a kid or if you are going to college this fall, please go to FAFSA.ed.gov. It's the first place to get a lot of financial aid that goes unclaimed, like Pell Grants. But even if you attended school last year, you just finished up college, you may still qualify for some government aid for the previous year, but you have to fill it out soon. Go to FAFSA.ed.gov, and we'll have that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And this FAFSA has been streamlined, so it's not quite
as
onerous.
It's still a pain, but it's much better than it was, and it's really the best place to get any extra money for college.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
That makes sense to me. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8 and rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.